Chapter 9 Dog's Body. In the middle of August, a new prisoner, with an awkward walk and a distinctive air of authority, entered the castle and sent a ripple of excitement through the camp. Wing Commander Douglas Bader would become the most famous prisoner in Colditz. He was already the most celebrated fighting soldier on either side of the entire war. Fame had come to him suddenly, by way of an appalling accident, leading to a lifetime of acute pain. In later years, he raised millions for disability charities. He was supremely brave, able to inspire others to feats of courage they never dreamed possible. But he was also arrogant, domineering, selfish, and spectacularly rude, particularly to those he considered of lower status. Many of his closest comrades adored him. The war had made him into a hero, but it also made him insufferable. Bader was the neglected child of a distant mother and a father who had died of wounds sustained in the trenches when his son was 12 years old. He grew up angry and bullied. At public school, he was once beaten up by Laurence Olivier after he bowled out the future actor in a cricket match. He masked his loneliness with bluster, aggression, and exhibitionism. In 1928, he joined the RAF, and 2 years later, he was commissioned pilot officer. In defiance of regulations, he took to performing competitive aerobatic stunts in his Bristol Bulldog biplane. In December 1931, on a dare, he attempted a slow roll over Woodley Aerodrome near Reading. Flying in too low, his left wing clipped the ground and the plane somersaulted. Pulled from the wreckage, Bader would have died at the scene if a civilian had not held on to the severed femoral artery in his right leg. By another stroke of good fortune, he was brought to hospital just in time to catch pioneering surgeon Leonard Joyce before he went home for the day. Writing up the incident in his logbook, Bader was laconic. Crashed slow rolling near ground. Bad show. He did not mention that Joyce had amputated both of his legs, one above and one below the knee. With the use of two prosthetic legs, slightly longer than the original ones to make him taller, Bader was able to drive a modified car, play golf and cricket, swim and even dance. But to his fury, the RAF would not let him fly. He took a desk job with an oil company. Bader never stopped lobbying the RAF to put him back in a cockpit, insisting he could pilot a plane just as effectively with prosthetic legs. "By God, I'll sit on their doorsteps until I get in," he vowed. With war, the authorities relented, and he returned to the air. During the Battle of France and the Battle of Britain, he distinguished himself as a fighter pilot of reckless skill and supreme courage. He argued in favour of deploying mass fighter formations and developed techniques for ambushing enemy planes using the sun and altitude. In the space of 2 years, using the call sign Dog's Body from his initials, DB, he shot down 20 enemy planes, shared in 4 more aerial victories and 6 probables. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Order and Bar, and then the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the aerial war, so many were indebted to so few, and few were owed so much by so many as Douglas Bader. But he might have remained just another fighter pilot had the War Office not spotted a golden propaganda opportunity. The tale of Britain's double amputee flying ace was exactly the sort of story to uplift and inspire the public in the darkest days of war. So, in a meticulously executed public relations campaign, the Air Ministry set about turning Bader into a legend by planting a series of newspaper stories. The Daily Mail interviewed the pilot's mother, who declared, "I wish I could tell you adequately the story of how he had to face life again without two legs. It was amazing to watch the gradual return of his sunny disposition." A description of Bader's temperament so wildly at odds with reality that it reinforces how little she really knew him. The Daily Mirror hailed the greatest hero of them all, Britain's most amazing RAF fighter command pilot. By early 1941, he was the country's first officially sanctioned poster boy, photographed alongside his Spitfire, a square-jawed, pugnacious warrior, pipe in fist, the very incarnation of determination to overcome the odds on earth and in the air. Newspapers competed to describe his daredevil escapades. Bader lapped up the attention. He was unconditionally adored by the public and deeply resented by colleagues familiar with the man behind this hastily assembled myth. One of his fellow pilots observed, "He was a show-off, the most pompous chap I've ever met." Few glimpsed the other Bader, quiet and alone. He treated the ground crew with withering superiority, and they detested him. Some put his fearlessness down to a complete absence of imagination. Bader was living evidence that it is possible to be courageous, famous, disabled, and quite unpleasant all at the same time. On the 9th of August 1941, Bader's 616 squadron was flying an offensive sortie over the coast of France when he spotted a dozen Messerschmitt 109s flying in formation below him. "Dog's body attacking," he radioed. "Plenty for all. Take 'em as they come." He dived, shot down one German plane, and was opening fire on a second when he felt a tremendous impact and turned to see the rear fuselage, tail, and fin of his Spitfire had been torn away. Bader believed he must have collided in the air with a German fighter. More likely, he was the victim of friendly fire from another fighter, though he never admitted this. He jettisoned the cockpit canopy and released his harness pin. But as the rushing air started to suck him out of the stricken plane, his prosthetic right leg became trapped under the joystick. Spinning towards Earth at 400 miles an hour, battered in the slipstream and losing consciousness, he pulled the ripcord of his parachute. The violent jerk as it opened snapped the leather strap holding his leg in place, and Bader floated free. A German patrol picked up the one-legged parachutist with two broken ribs minutes after he landed and took him to a hospital in Saint-Omer. The damaged prosthetic limb was found in a nearby field. The famous pilot was treated with elaborate courtesy by his German captors. In an act of bizarre gallantry, they informed the British that Bader's artificial right leg was no longer fit for purpose and invited the RAF to send a replacement. Sure enough, with Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring's official approval, the unimaginatively named Operation Leg was launched on the 19th of August, when an RAF bomber was given safe conduct over Saint-Omer and dropped a new prosthesis by parachute on the nearest Luftwaffe base in occupied France, along with stump socks, powder, tobacco, and chocolate. With two operative legs, Bader immediately tried to escape. He climbed out of the hospital window, lowered himself to the ground with a bedsheet rope, and hobbled off. He was captured a few hours later, hiding in a garden. Transferred to Lübeck camp, he escaped again and was recaptured. Yet another attempt from Stalag 8B at Lambsdorff also ended in failure. Bader's prosthetic limbs impeded his escape efforts, but so did his fame. Each camp commandant was deluged with requests from local bigwigs who wanted a chance to see him. A German poster was printed, describing his distinctive, stiff-legged gait in case he should escape again. He was a captive of his own notoriety. Bader was about as deutschfeindlich as it was possible to be, an incorrigible prisoner and a valuable propaganda prize. Germany's highest security prisoner of war camp was the obvious place to put him. This, then, was the warrior celebrity saluted by the admiring German sentries as he clumped into Colditz on the 18th of August 1942. A man with legs of tin a heart of oak, and feet of clay. The cobbled slope up from the moat was too steep for Barda's rigid legs, and so he was pulled along by his batman, a diminutive, bespectacled Scottish medical orderly from Renfrewshire named Alex Ross, who also carried Barda's luggage and spare legs. Both had been imprisoned in Lambsdorff. He asked if I would go with him to Colditz, but warned me it was a bad boys' camp, Ross recalled. Compared to other prisons he had known, Colditz struck Ross as a bloody good place. What I didn't realise was that being Barda's orderly was a 24-hours-a-day job. I soon realised why none of the other orderlies wanted to work for him. You had to be at his beck and call all the time. I know he was a very brave man, but he could also be a monster. Ross's jobs included serving Barda breakfast in bed every morning. He would then carry the officer on his back down two flights of winding stairs for his bath and back up again afterwards. He was no lightweight, said Ross. He would have his arms round my neck, hanging on, and would dig the stumps of his legs hard into me in order to hold on. And I did that every day of the week. Barda liked to refer to his batman steed as Das Ross, an old German word for a horse or charger, of the sort a knight might ride into battle. At Colditz, Barda appointed himself to a number of prominent positions. Orchestra conductor, goalie in games of stoolball, and goon-baiter in chief. He successfully campaigned to be allowed to take long walks outside the castle walls, insisting there was not enough space in the courtyard to exercise the muscles in what remained of his legs. Twice a week, Barda set off on his parole walks under guard and used the opportunity to trade with local farmers, swapping Red Cross chocolate for fresh eggs and other luxuries. His artificial legs were regularly repaired and serviced by the Colditz town blacksmith. Despite these marks of respect, Barda treated his captors with profanity-laden contempt, unmercifully baiting the Germans on every possible occasion. He blew pipe smoke in the sentries' faces, refused to salute any German of lower rank than him, led the chorus in anti-German chanting, and instituted a system of organised, tuneless whistling whenever the guards were marching past, to throw them out of step. Once, when Ross was carrying him upstairs after his bath, they encountered a German general and two colonels coming the other way. "Don't stop for these bastards," Barda shouted, digging his stumps into his orderly. They looked quite shocked, but stepped back to let us go by. He just glared at them. As ever, Barda provoked contrasting feelings. Many younger officers were inspired and amused by his restless defiance. Douglas provided the fun. The more impolite he was to the Germans, the greater their respect. A strange and unpredictable character, his was the most magnetic personality in the prison, said one fellow officer. Even Eggers was a little daunted by this celebrity inmate. Others found him intensely irritating, pointing out that by goading the Germans, he provoked collective punishments that adversely affected everyone in the camp. His rudeness was legendary. "I don't think all the time I knew him he said please or thank you," recalled Ross. Barda never offered his batman any of the eggs he obtained on his countryside walks. "I think if he had handed me one, I would have fainted." Barda's tin legs obviously made him ineligible for escapes requiring physical agility, such as tunnelling or climbing across roofs. Nonetheless, he demanded a place on every escape plan. When the escape committee refused, he raged, "Do you realise that the government at home would rather have me back than all the rest of you put together?" This assertion, though supremely arrogant, was probably true. At one point, the committee sent a secret message to London, suggesting that a splendid propaganda coup could be achieved by landing a light aircraft on the Autobahn near Colditz and so rescuing Douglas Barda. MI9 did not dismiss this balmy idea out of hand. The government wanted Bader back in Britain, and many in Colditz would have been happy to see him go. The morning roll call on the 10th of September revealed that no fewer than 10 prisoners were missing. Chaos ensued. Two British officers were found in the Dutch lines. Eggers checked the Dutch contingent against their photographs and found 3 had vanished. To add to the pandemonium, a British officer tossed a bucket of water out of a window as the recount was taking place. One of the British, formally identified under one name, turned out to be someone else completely. 4 ghosts were found hiding in the attics. Once the confusion had died down, it emerged that 6 prisoners, 3 Dutch, 1 British, 1 Canadian and an Australian, had got away. Eggers quickly found out how. They had picked the cruciform lock of the only office used by the Germans that faced into the prisoners' courtyard, burrowed through the floor beneath the desk into the storeroom below, and re-emerged just after the guard changed, as a team of uniformed Polish orderlies under the command of a German NCO. By good fortune, the German sentry guarding the gate out of the park fell for this disguise and obligingly opened it. 4 of the escapers were quickly apprehended, but 2, a Dutchman posing as an architecture student and an Australian airman pretending to be a Belgian labourer, evaded the search parties. 87 hours after leaving Colditz, they crossed into Switzerland at the Singen Salient wearing civilian clothes. The hole in the office floor was sealed up, and yet more security measures were imposed. A machine gun tower on the northwest corner of the terrace, with a clear line of fire down the northern and western sides. A catwalk manned by a sentry over the barbed wire gate on the east side. More powerful floodlights in the inner courtyard. The seam, where the prisoners' quarters adjoined the German quarters, always the weakest point of security, was networked with alarm wires under the plaster. Every escape attempt, successful or otherwise, made the next a little harder. For Hauptmann Reinhold Eggers, the war had so far proven to be, if not exactly enjoyable, then perfectly tolerable. He missed his wife back in Halle. He worried for the safety of his 2 sons, one fighting in North Africa and the other in Nazi-occupied Norway. The prisoners could be extremely irritating, and their insolence continued to vex him. Yet he relished the challenge of pitting his wits against the escapers in what he called a permanent game of leapfrog. First we were ahead with our security barriers, then they were, scheming around them. Eggers was making quite a name for himself within the German military prison service. When General Henri Giraud escaped from Königstein Castle, a camp for senior French and Polish officers in Saxony, Eggers was sent to investigate. Sure enough, my Colditz methods yielded the desired result. He concluded that the French general had escaped by scaling down the outside of the fortress using telephone cable smuggled to him by his wife, hidden inside a large ham. When the prison authorities opened a central escape museum in Vienna, Eggers was flattered to be asked to supply specimens of our best escape material from our collection of photographs of tunnels, contraband, fake passes, keys, disguises, etc. He gave tours of Germany's highest security prison to visiting dignitaries, and in October, to his intense gratification, he was invited to a conference on prisoner policy in Dresden. Fame at last, he wrote, without irony. The Colditz Escape Academy was now getting some recognition. His museum was becoming an obsession. He made 6 German sentries dress up as Polish orderlies in order to photograph a reenactment of the September escape. When a French officer was caught trying to walk out disguised in overalls as the civilian camp electrician, Willy Pernet, Eggers had him pose for a photograph alongside his doppelganger, adding another remarkable image to his growing collection. Eggers was 52 years old, and he had found his calling. He was fast becoming Germany's foremost expert on escapology. the Sherlock Holmes of the Sonderlager. A bright future beckoned whenever Germany won the war. But that victory, once an imminent certainty, was starting to look more distant by the autumn of 1942. German soldiers were being fed into the slaughter fields of the Eastern Front at a terrifying rate. The tide of war was turning in North Africa, where Rommel was now in retreat after the Second Battle of El Alamein. With the increasing demand for frontline troops, the Colditz garrison was reduced. The coal ration was cut by a third. Despite the enmity between the guarded and the guards, inside Colditz this was still a gentlemanly war between soldiers who adhered to similar military codes of honour. But, as Eggers observed, the war outside was taking an unpleasant turn, and the ugliness was seeping into the camp. The German High Command was increasingly enraged by Allied commando raids launched against targets in Nazi-occupied Europe. The Dieppe raid, the capture of prisoners on the Channel Island of Sark, the assassination of the brutal SS tyrant Reinhard Heydrich in Czechoslovakia. The perpetrators of these assaults, the Nazis claimed, were criminal bandits, tying up prisoners and executing unarmed captives. In July came the order that captured parachutists should be handed over to the Gestapo. Downed bomber crews were in increasing danger of being lynched by enraged groups of vigilantes. These pilots were safe, and by that I mean comparatively safe, only when they got into Wehrmacht hands, wrote Eggers. Escaping was becoming more dangerous. Prisoners found outside the walls, in civilian clothes or disguised as German soldiers, were more likely to be accused of espionage and handed over to the Gestapo or the SS, brutal fanatics with no interest in following even the most basic rules of war. As the tide of war began to turn, the Nazi Party tightened its grip. The party leaders in Colditz town were taking a greater interest in what was happening in the castle. Visits from the Gestapo to inspect security arrangements became more frequent. Within the German mess itself, the split was widening between those, like Eggers, who felt that the prisoners should be treated in accordance with regulations, and the hawks, who favoured more ruthless measures to keep the inmates in line. On the 7th of October, seven new prisoners arrived in Colditz to be photographed before being swiftly hustled off to the town cells, away from the other inmates. No one knew who they were or where they had come from. Dominic Bruce was still in the town solitary cells following his failed packing case escape, and during an exercise session he managed to exchange a few words with the leader of the group. "Who are you?" Bruce whispered. "Who are you?" the man responded. "I'm an RAF officer." "Where from?" "I'm a Tynesider, but I haven't been there for a while," said Bruce. "Where are you from?" There was a pause before the soldier replied. "Norway." "Well, if you want any messages sent home to England, we can send them for you," said Bruce. "Tell them things went all right in Norway." The man's name was Captain Graham Black, a 31-year-old Canadian from Ontario, and the leader of Operation Musketoon, one of the most daring secret sabotage missions of the war. 2 weeks earlier, Black had led a team of 9 British and 2 Norwegian commandos in an attack on the Glomfjord power plant in Nazi-occupied Norway, a large hydroelectric works powering an aluminium factory that supplied important war material to the Germans. Transported to the coast of Norway by submarine, the saboteurs paddled ashore in dinghies in the dead of night, armed with rifles, Sten guns, pistols and fighting knives. The team was also carrying dried meat, wire cutters, halibut oil, tinted spectacles against snow blindness, Horlicks, binoculars and Benzedrine tablets. Having scaled a sheer cliff to the plant, they ushered the Norwegian night staff to safety, attached delayed-action plastic explosives to the machinery, pipeline and generators, and headed inland. They were a mile away when it blew up, with a colossal explosion which made the echoes ring from all the mountains round about. An hour later, they were intercepted by a search party. Two Germans and one of the commandos were killed in the ensuing firefight. The attackers then split into two parties. One group of four made it safely to neutral Sweden. The remaining seven were captured and taken to Colditz. 3 days after their arrival, Eggers was seen accompanying four Gestapo officers to the town jail. Black and his second-in-command were removed. 3 days later, a routine inspection of their vacated cell revealed that the window bars had been sawn through in three places. The cuts are filled with chewed bread, very neatly and hardly visible, wrote an impressed Schädlich. This unit has been really well trained. Inside a comb sheath belonging to one of the commandos, the Germans found a steel saw blade. One of the men, 21-year-old Private Eric Curtis, scribbled in a diary, "We feel really happy, as if we were on holiday. Red Cross parcels with English food, chocolate, tea, milk, sugar. Tonight we feel really terrific. Red Cross marmalade makes bread taste like home." That was the last entry in Curtis's diary. Schädlich found it in his cell. The next day, Curtis and his four companions were escorted under heavy guard to a waiting bus and driven away. Three of them were just 20 years old. The oldest was 28. Their names and ranks, obtained by the orderly Solly Goldman while serving them breakfast in solitary, were passed on to MI9 in a coded letter that would later feature in evidence at the Nuremberg trials. When the senior British officer at Colditz demanded to know what had become of these men, Glacier equivocated. They were merely passing through the camp, coming from a place he did not know and going to a destination which he did not know. On the 18th of October, Hitler issued his Kommandobefehl, or Commando Order, a glaring breach of the Geneva Convention, ordering that all captured Allied commandos, in or out of uniform, should be summarily executed without trial, even if they had surrendered. All men operating against German troops in so-called commando raids are to be annihilated to the last man. No pardon is on any account to be given. The order warned that any German officer who failed to carry out this execution order would be punished. The last vestige of Nazi respect for international law was evaporating. The survivors of Operation Musketoon were locked into the basement cells of the Reich Security Headquarters in Berlin. There they were personally interrogated by Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, one of Hitler's most brutal functionaries, and one of the few whose post-war fate has never been ascertained. On the 22nd of October, the seven commandos were chained together, loaded onto a truck, and taken to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, an hour's drive north of the city. At dawn the next day, the men were led out and then murdered by their SS guards, one by one, with a single pistol shot to the back of the neck. The German authorities told the Red Cross and the Swiss protecting power that the commandos had escaped. Letters addressed to the seven at Colditz were returned unopened, marked geflohen, fled. Commandant Glacier must have known this was a lie. So, presumably, did Eggers. In his otherwise comprehensive account of life in Colditz, this terrible episode goes unmentioned. The queasy silence of guilt. Further evidence of Nazi depravity arrived in Colditz a few weeks later. Kit Silverwood Cope was another of Mrs. M's boys. For 14 months he had lived in Warsaw under the protection of Jane Walker's Anglo-Polish Society network, moving between safe houses. The first winter, struck down with typhus, he was nursed back to life by a Jewish doctor. But soon after Michael Sinclair made his abortive dash for the Bulgarian border, the network was infiltrated and destroyed. Under interrogation, two intercepted POWs revealed several key addresses. A Pole, working for the Germans, worked his way into Mrs. M's confidence by offering to spirit escapers out through Switzerland. The Gestapo pounced. Silverwood Cope and a dozen other escapers were arrested. The Jewish doctor and his family were sent to Auschwitz. Mrs. M was tipped off just in time and went into hiding in the Polish countryside, disguised as a peasant. Jane Walker's one-woman resistance campaign was over, but Mrs. M left a remarkable legacy. She had stiffened the sinews of countless fugitive soldiers, helped dozens to get away, and instilled in Michael Sinclair an escape lust that grew more urgent by the day. The Gestapo accused Silverwood Cope of spying and locked him in Paviak civilian prison. Starved, repeatedly interrogated, confined to a tiny, freezing cell, he lost a quarter of his body weight in 3 months. The prison was a place of unspeakable cruelty. By day, the screams of agony from prisoners being flogged was incessant. The Wehrmacht was still upholding the rules where possible. The army interceded and almost certainly saved Silverwood Cope's life by removing him to Colditz. He arrived an emaciated, traumatized ghost. Eggers at first refused to believe his description of conditions in Paviak. "The most dreadful things. Jews pushed down under manhole covers into drains full of dirty water and left to drown. Dogs set on prisoners. Prisoners beaten and hung by their wrists." Like many Germans, Eggers had hitherto dismissed tales of Nazi barbarity and mass murder as Allied propaganda. He was profoundly shocked. It was the first information that I had personally had from first-hand sources of what to me had till then been only rumours. Eggers was a prig, but he was neither a heartless man nor a stupid one. A small worm of doubt burrowed into his soul. Not only could Germany lose the war, she might deserve to. Pat Reed had planned, aided, approved, or taken part in virtually every escape attempt organised by the British. But of all the plans he vetted during 2 years of captivity, none was quite so foolhardy, so very likely to fail, as the one he was invited to join in November 1942. Four prisoners proposed to climb out of a window in the POW's kitchen, creep across the flat roof of the German kitchen in full view of the Kommandantur windows, sneak behind a sentry when his back was turned, and then crawl to a shallow pit on the south side of the German courtyard. In the corner was a door to a disused staircase that might lead to the empty upper floors of the German quarters, from which they planned to clamber down the outside walls on bedsheets, past rooms filled with sleeping German soldiers, and into the moat. Then they would take a train to the Swiss border, disguised as Flemish workmen. They had no idea what was behind the door or whether they could open it. "The scheme was lunatic," declared Reed. He accepted the invitation without hesitation. This would be his sixth escape attempt, and he knew his last. "I resolved I would not come back if I ever escaped again." On the 14th of October, Reed and three other British officers, dressed in civilian clothes and carrying suitcases as additional disguise, climbed onto the German roof, a floodlit stage overlooked by several hundred windows. At that moment, Douglas Bader was conducting the Colditz Orchestra in a rehearsal of Mozart's Oboe Concerto, and the music was clearly audible in the German courtyard. Stooges were watching and signalling to the conductor. When the sentry turned his back, Bader would lower his baton. As the guard turned around, Bader would resume conducting and the orchestra struck up again. Reed strained to pick up the musical cues. The music kept jolting to a halt and then raggedly restarting, possibly because most of the orchestra, unaware of what was happening, could not follow Bader's bizarre conducting technique. Reed decided to chance it. One by one, the men dropped onto the cobbles, dived into a flowerbed, and then crawled over to the shallow pit. Anyone glancing out of the windows would have seen them. The ancient lever lock securing the staircase door resisted every effort to pick it, perhaps because it had not been opened for years. After an hour, Reed gave up. The orchestra had dispersed, and the courtyard was silent. A few yards away, the sentry paced up and down. It was already 11 p.m. From the pit, Reed could see an archway with stone steps leading down into a cellar. That door was unlocked. The men slipped inside. At the far end of the cellar, a thin ray of light from the exterior floodlight revealed a ventilation shaft or disused chimney flue. Reed peered up it. I could see that it led to a barred opening on the far side of the building, where lay the moat. Reed stripped off his clothes and wriggled up the narrow brick chute. One of the bars was loose in its socket. He prized it up and bent it back, and then dragged himself, inch by inch, through the wall, finally flopping onto the terrace outside. The next man, Hank Wardle, was stouter. Reed hauled on his outstretched hand. The others pushed from below. At the end of 20 minutes, with a last wrench, I pulled him clear. He was bruised all over and streaming with perspiration. It was now 3 a.m. The four men dressed quickly, descended the 3 12-foot terraces into the moat, and set off down to the park. In the bushes on the far side of the wall, they shook hands, whispered farewell in the darkness, split into pairs, and parted. 3 weeks later, Rupert Barry, the codemaker, received a postcard from Switzerland. It read, "We are having a holiday here and are sorry you are not with us. Give our dear love to your friend Dick." Dick Howe had taken over from Reed as British escape officer. The card was signed Harriet and Phyllis Murgatroyd. The H and the P were heavily inked. Hank Wardle and Pat Reed were in Switzerland. Their two companions had reached safety a day later. It was the most successful single breakout to date. Reed remained in Switzerland for the rest of the war, where he worked for MI6, gathering intelligence from other escapers. Once back in Britain, he forged an astonishingly successful career as the principal eyewitness historian of Colditz, even though, as some of his fellow inmates sourly pointed out, he had been in it for under half its life as a POW camp. The British were now top of the unofficial Escapers League for 1942, having achieved 7 home runs in the space of a year. Michael Sinclair was determined to be next. With approval from the International Escape Committee, he teamed up with a French officer named Charles Klein, and on the 25th of November, in broad daylight after the midday meal, they climbed out of the light well of the theatre, through the German kitchens, into the Kommandantur courtyard, and then walked out of the gate. An exit so brazen that it worked. Then they split up. Klein was recaptured at Plauen. With Mrs. M's Polish network broken up, Sinclair instead headed south for Singen. He was caught just a few miles from the Swiss border. Eggers collected him from Weinsberg police station and found the recaptured officer in a filthy mood, monosyllabic and uncooperative. Sinclair later lodged an official complaint that Eggers had behaved in an ungentlemanly fashion by ordering a meal in the station restaurant without inviting the prisoner to join him. "This beats everything," wrote Eggers. "Such arrogance!" Ever punctilious, Eggers formally noted that he had given Sinclair a bottle of lemonade and some soup. Sinclair was not so much arrogant as ferociously frustrated. He was the ideal escaper, young, energetic, imaginative, and brave. He merely lacked the one resource essential to every successful escape. Luck. Sinclair longed to rejoin the battle, but with every failure, the prospect of playing a useful part in the war seemed to recede a little further. Colditz prisoners were not supposed to know what was happening in the wider conflict. Incoming letters were rigorously censored, and the German newspapers permitted inside the camp offered a uniformly rosy and misleading version of events. Yet the prisoners clearly had access to other news sources. Occasionally, they dropped demoralizing remarks to the guards, pointing out that Germany's war was not progressing in the way Nazi propaganda claimed. The Allies were advancing in North Africa. The German army was bogged down in the Russian winter. The French seemed particularly well informed. Neither gossip nor incoming prisoners could account for all they now and then admitted to knowing, Eggers noted. The French knew more about the war than he did, and early in December, a traitor in the French camp revealed why. They were listening to the BBC. The ingenious lockpicker, Fredo Gieg, had smuggled in a three-valve radio through the parcels office, concealed inside a food package from his wife. The radio, codenamed Arthur or Arthur, was hidden behind a wall on the top floor of the French quarters in a room occupied by the curate. It was disguised by a large map of Africa drawn on the wall. The black dots marking towns on the map were in fact sockets for the headphone plugs. The tuning knob was underneath Dakar. News was gathered nightly from the BBC French service and passed on to the other nations without revealing the whereabouts of the radio. Eggers found the radio on the 15th of December, French make, tuned to London, after conducting an elaborate investigation of the Keller House to make it appear as if the discovery was the result of a routine search. His underlings knew better. Schädlich wrote in his diary, "A radio installation as cleverly hidden and disguised as this one would not have been found without being betrayed." Years later, Eggers admitted that he had been tipped off by a French informant, and though he passed on the name of the spy to Gieg after the war, he insisted that this not be revealed until 2000. In that year, the spy was identified as Julien Carignard, an NCO from Marseille and the assistant curate. Carignard was set free in return for revealing the radio's hiding place. "In order not to arouse suspicions, we transferred him with some others to a different camp." Eggers put it about that the Frenchman had subsequently been released on health grounds. Carignard abandoned the priesthood after the war and died with his treachery unrevealed. "There are no more radios in the camp," Eggers reassured Berlin emphatically, and wrongly. As insurance, Gieg had already built a second radio, from parts shipped in different parcels by the resourceful and obliging Madame Gieg. Arthur II, hidden in the attics under a pile of broken tiles, was up and running on the very evening that Arthur I was confiscated. "There was no break in our radio service," wrote Gieg. The flurry of successful escapes and the encouraging war news lent a prematurely optimistic flavour to that Christmas, a belief that captivity might soon be at an end. The men took bets on when the war would be won. A Christmas Day truce was agreed with the commandant, under which the prisoners promised not to escape and the Germans left the lights on until 1 a.m. Time was beginning to concertina, one year merging into the next. "Tonight's celebration had nothing new in it," remarked Padre Platt. "It was just a repetition of last year and the year before, but with more hope." This Colditz Christmas differed from its predecessors in one other respect. It was spectacularly drunken. The illicit production of alcohol had come a long way since the crude and fearsome spirit brewed up by the early Polish distillers. Prison moonshine was made by mixing sugar and yeast with ersatz jam, mashed fruit or vegetables. The resulting mixture was left in a warm cupboard to ferment for 6 weeks before being distilled with a rustic Liebig condenser constructed from stolen toilet piping to produce a clear alcohol of 120 degrees proof. This hooch still had to be made palatable by flavouring it with whatever came to hand. More fruit, brown sugar, or, in one instance, Chanel No. 5 aftershave sent in a care package. Jam alk was grim stuff. It resulted in inebriation, to be sure, but also blurred vision, vomiting, nightmares, black teeth, a swollen tongue, and, as the effects wore off, headaches of cataclysmic violence. One Colditz distiller named his whiskey Glen Bucket. Left overnight, it could eat through the bottom of an enamel cup. Prisoners who overindulged were said to be jam happy. The Germans at first tried to prevent alcohol production, but eventually tolerated it as a welcome distraction. Pickled prisoners were often less trouble than the sober variety. Though one drinker developed cirrhosis and a few went briefly blind, no one died of alcohol poisoning. And as the former medical student Peter Story Pugh observed, alcohol in moderation had an enormously good effect on morale. The quality of the homemade hooch steadily improved. Michael Farr, a vintner and oenophile whose family owned Hawker's Gin, emerged as chief purveyor of wines and spirits to Colditz, with the encouragement of Eggers, who not only allowed us to continue brewing, but in fact helped us by giving us rough clay wine jars. Over the course of his imprisonment, Farr developed a pure white schnapps and a slow gin, as well as remarkably good rosé and white wines from a variety of dried fruits, including apricots, prunes, raisins and sultanas. Farr's Grand Cru was Château Colditz, a demi-sec sparkling wine made using the méthode champenoise pioneered around 1810 by Veuve Clicquot, the grande dame of Champagne. This wine was fermented in Eggers's jars using raisins, water and sugar, clarified and filtered through charcoal, bottled, and laid to rest corked down for a fortnight until all the sediment had gathered at the neck. Then it was placed upside down on a window ledge in a tray of snow, ice and salt, until the cork and first inch of wine had frozen solid. Then the cork and iced sediment were removed, leaving a bright, clear wine with all the yeast removed. Farr added a little more sugar to each bottle before re-corking. An excellent sparkling wine resulted, which was served chilled. Christmas dinner was tomato soup, steak and onions, sardines on toast, and Christmas pudding with custard, washed down with prodigious quantities of this prisoner's Prosecco and digestifs of various sorts. Instead of dining in their separate messes, the British officers crammed into the long room. The orderlies dined separately, and no less lavishly. Le vin de Château Colditz flowed freely in all quarters, wrote Platt. A sweepstake was held on when Tripoli would fall to the Allies. National songs were bellowed in the courtyard. The booze, Farr noted, created a lot of merriment and high spirits, and we forgot where we were for a short time. 1943 dawned with a thumping hangover. The effects of the jam alk wore off, bringing back the grim knowledge that the war might not be over by the next Christmas, or the one after that. Unlike ordinary convicts, for prisoners of war, the day of freedom is not set by judge or jury, but by events in a distant theatre of conflict. Liberty is an unknowable appointment with fate that might come soon, eventually, or never. Alan Campbell, one of several Colditz poets, wrote, "Our cross is the curse of waiting." Frustration was mounting. Apart from the possible murder in the parcels office, no prisoner had ever attacked a guard in Colditz. But a few days after New Year, Eggers was standing in the prisoner's courtyard talking to another German officer when a large lump of snow fizzed past his head and smashed into the door of the canteen with a loud thud. This was no ordinary snowball. It was thrown with such force, wrote Eggers, that in the mush left on the door, I found a very large piece of bottle glass stuck into the wood. The snowball thrower had intended serious injury. The war, inside and outside Colditz, was growing nastier.